girl. I'm inside peeking out the curtains at them. I finally got mad, and we ended up leaving early. In fact, we left one evening and drove all night so as to not stay at Bart's any longer. But the anger didn't last, and neither did our other relationships. Even though I dated other guys, they all knew they were second to Bart, and I cared more for him. When he came around, I always made time. Christian bands typically don't travel around the holidays unless they have released a Christmas album or are going on a holiday tour. During December, most churches focus on their Sunday school gatherings, Advent programs, and nativity pageants. So I headed home for Christmas just a few days after Shannon had made her abrupt exit from my house in Nashville. On Sunday morning, I sat down beside her in the church pew and asked, "So why did you just leave town so quickly without even saying goodbye?" She grinned and answered, "Because you were being such a jerk." We both laughed, I told her I was sorry, and we were quickly back to our old selves again. Save the best for last. Remember Kent, our third musketeer? Well, Kent was getting married at the beginning of the new year, so Shannon and I were looking forward to his wedding. Honestly, it almost overshadowed Christmas that year. We both planned on being part of all the festivities. I mean, how great could Kent's wedding be if all three musketeers weren't there to celebrate? Because a lot of our friends had left town after New Year's Day, Shannon and I ended up hanging out the entire time the week before the wedding. The first night, she talked to me for hours about her longtime boyfriend. As was typical, I just kept telling her that she needed to break up with him sooner than later. Don't get me wrong, I listened and heard her out as she processed the relationship, but my advice never changed. I had told many of my friends if I could find someone like Shannon, my problems would be solved. I ended up comparing every girl I date to her. That night, I almost told her what I had been telling everyone else, but I caught myself just before it slipped out of my mouth. Then the truth finally took root. It had been standing right in front of me the entire time, for all those years, as I went through girl after girl. Vanessa Williams had a hit song years ago, "Save the Best for Last," about finally realizing the right one had been in front of you all along. I'd been saving the best for last, and thank God she was still available. Through our conversations early that week, we each realized we were never going to marry the people we were dating. Without knowing what the other was doing, Shannon and I called off our other relationships. I wasn't 100% sure everything was going to work out with Shannon, but I knew in my heart that no girl deserved to be compared to another the way I was doing. I knew it wasn't fair to her and not right for either of us. I was glad to finally get the shot of courage to say no, no matter what might happen in any other relationship. Late that week, we had a heartfelt, honest talk about the elephant in the room. We asked each other what in the world we had been doing with these other people when we were obviously supposed to be together. And then came the bombshell. We each realized the other had broken off the current relationship. I was looking for another Shannon and not finding her. She was looking for another Bart and not finding him. So here we were, finally facing the truth together. God seemed to be making it quite clear what he had in store for us. We had finally confessed our feelings to each other, and then that week culminated in us going together to our best friend's wedding. How much more encouragement did we need? Now we just had to give it all to the Lord for his timing. We prayed about what these changes meant for our future and asked God to reveal his will to us. Shannon's side of the story. That Christmas, I was a senior in college. I knew in my heart the guy I was dating was not right for me. He wasn't seeking the Lord. I even asked him to quote John 3:16, and he didn't know it. I wasn't trying to judge him. I just realized he was not going to be able to lead me spiritually in the way God wanted, and I wanted. So while I felt really bad about handling it this way, I broke up with him on the phone over Christmas break. I had made up my mind and didn't want to have to dread going back to school, knowing I would be ending it right at the start of the spring semester. I wanted us both to have the space between semesters and go back in January with a fresh start. Bart had come home for Christmas too, and we started hanging out again every day before the wedding. He ended up breaking up with his girlfriend around the same time I did with my boyfriend. We spent a lot of time with each other that week. Then at the wedding, something happened. After that, we started dating again. The Lord gave me obvious signs of confirmation. There was just peace. Bart and I connected so easily and naturally, it wasn't work at all, just a new dimension to our long-term friendship. Our relationship really felt like home. You know me. One day, not long after we started praying for God's guidance, I read Psalm 139. You have searched me, Lord, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you, Lord, know it completely. Verses 1 through 4. I thought of how Shannon had been so present throughout my life, how well she knew me, really knew me. God knew everything about me, and I felt his intention was for Shannon and me to be together. There was always a sacredness and purity about my relationship with her, even in the midst of all the craziness of my life. I called Shannon and told her I needed to see her. She told me there was something she wanted to share with me, too. When we got together that evening, I, Southern gentleman that I am, insisted, "You go first." Shannon's side of the story. Rebecca St. James, a popular Christian singer at the time, had a song called Psalm 139. The words from the passage really moved me, and I wanted to play the song for Bart, but he said he had something to read to me. I could see he had his Bible open to Psalms as I played him the song and told him the story. Then he showed me what he was going to read to me. God had brought us to the same scripture. I thought, I've known since I was 13, and this is it. When Shannon was done, I was in shock. I told her I had the same experience reading that exact scripture passage. The Holy Spirit used his word to tell us he created us for each other from the very beginning and then orchestrated our individual circumstances so we could now be together. Talk about a handwritten message from God himself. But you surpass them all. When someone asks me to describe Shannon, the first words that come to mind are innocent, forgiving, kind, encouraging, intelligent, and just plain awesome. She has always been the sweetest person I have ever known. She has no hidden agenda and no ulterior motives behind her love and care for people. Everything about Shannon was better than me. People jokingly say about their significant others, "She's my better half," but I can tell you that for me, it is completely and absolutely true. I had always found something about every girl I dated that would drive me crazy, some personality trait or quirk that I couldn't stand. That wasn't true with Shannon. There were so many times when the other girls would say or do something and I would think, "Shannon would never say that," or "Shannon would never do that." I could find flaws in everyone in my life, except Shannon. Of course I know she does have flaws, but I was so in love with her that I did not care. I wasn't focused on negatives, but rather on who she was, and who I was when I was with her. Shannon makes me a better Bart, no question. Return engagement. By January 1997, we had realized what God already knew. We were meant to be together. 2 months later, in March, the band was booked to play at a student event in Glorieta, New Mexico, at the same camp where Shannon and I first started to hang out. She was going to be on her spring break, so she asked about going with us. Of course, I agreed. Then I realized I would be able to take her back to the same tree where we had our first kiss. That gave me an idea. Just as I had on that summer night all those years ago, I asked her to take a walk with me, and I led her to our tree. I stopped under the overhanging branches, got down on one knee, took out the engagement ring, and asked her to marry me. She said yes. You weren't surprised, were you? She was graduating from college in May, and we wanted to plan the wedding to happen as soon as possible after she got her diploma. Shannon's parents had gotten married on Saturday, November 8th, and in 1997, the date was also on a Saturday. Perfect. We thought it was such a great legacy for us to follow in the footsteps of her mom and dad. On the road again. When the band had moved from Nashville back to the Dallas area, I had moved to Arlington, a part of the Dallas-Fort Worth metroplex. After our wedding and honeymoon, Shannon and I lived there to be centrally located but still near our families in Greenville, about 75 miles away. Although Shannon had a degree in psychology and counseling, for 3 months she worked a full-time office job at the University of Texas at Arlington so we could make ends meet. I was on the road constantly, and we didn't see each other nearly enough, especially for newlyweds. One day when we were talking about the frustration of being apart so much, I reached my limit and blurted, "Just quit and come on the road with me." Shannon's mouth dropped open and all she could manage was, "What?" Always the solid, conservative, responsible one in this union, she started giving me 99 reasons why that wouldn't work, with most of them having to do with money. But I insisted, "The money will come, somehow. We'll trust God for what we need." Mustering up her faith, Shannon put in her notice at the university and we hit the road together. Shannon's side of the story. Quitting my job and going on the road with Bart was a decision that ran opposite of the way I was raised, but we did it for our marriage. I started traveling with four guys and my husband in a stripped-down bus with no air conditioning and no heat, and we traveled all over the country in all four seasons. Some mornings when I woke up on the twin mattresses where we all slept, I would find myself nose-to-nose with Jim or Mike instead of Bart. When I say we were all close, I mean literally. But with all the inconveniences, especially for a girl, I thought this life was awesome. I loved it. Growing up, my family wasn't able to go on very many vacations or trips, so this was heaven to me. I was getting to see the world, and I was absolutely fine hanging out with guys all the time. There was never any drama. There was constant fun. We were always laughing. I never, ever complained. In my humble opinion, while Shannon has always been an optimist, I do remember some drama and a little complaining from time to time during those years on the road. Here are a couple of memorable stories from those days. One winter, we were given a small propane heater to use on the bus. Early one morning, we stopped to eat breakfast at a diner. Shannon was still asleep, and we didn't want to wake her, so we left her on the bus alone. You're saying, uh-oh, again, aren't you? On the way out the door, we decided to start up the heater to keep her warm. While we were feeding our faces inside, the bus filled up with smoke. By the grace of God, Shannon woke up, bolted out of the bus, and came running to me. With tears in her eyes, she said she wasn't sure how much longer she could keep living like one of the guys. The good news is, thanks to her smoke-filled experience, we realized the time had come to get a nicer bus, one with carpet, seats, and even heat. On another run, we had to drive across the country from Washington, D.C. to California. We had to be in Los Angeles by a specific time, but Shannon hadn't seen the Grand Canyon before, so we checked the map and saw that we could route the trip through this part of Arizona and still make it to L.A. on time. When we got to the canyon, we slipped the transmission into neutral, stuck our heads out the windows, took a few quick pictures, and then kept on going. Cue Willie Nelson's theme song. If there's a world record for shortest visit to the Grand Canyon, surely our four-second drive-by would beat it. Technically, Shannon got to see the Grand Canyon, but sadly, there was no time to stop and take in the majestic view. I will always be thankful for God's infinite grace and mercy that allowed me the privilege of marrying my childhood sweetheart. After the horrible abuse I'd experienced in my life, after Dad's cancer and death, after dreams dying and being reborn, I thank and praise him for truly saving the best for last and allowing me the blessing of walking through life with my best friend. O Lord, you have examined my heart and know everything about me. You know when I sit down or stand up. You know my thoughts even when I'm far away. You see me when I travel and when I rest at home. You know everything I do. You know what I'm going to say even before I say it, Lord. You go before me and follow me. You place your hand of blessing on my head. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too great for me to understand. Psalm 139, 1 through 6, New Living Translation. Chapter 9, Everything Impossible. I was taught to be practical in everything I do, holding on to what is tangible, and then came you. That's when I found myself so far away from everything I knew. Mercy Me, Everything Impossible, from Undone, 2004. I was now a married man, making music on the road, traveling with my new bride and my band buddies. There's a scene in I Can Only Imagine where the guys ask if we are still a band, and I answer, no, we're a family. That was the absolute truth for me back then, and it still is today. Dad had died 7 years earlier. From the moment Mama Millard said to me as we were driving away from the graveside, I can only imagine what Bub must be seeing right now, I had not been able to get those first four words, that phrase, out of my mind. I can only imagine frequently popped into my head whenever I thought about the awe and wonders of heaven and seeing Jesus for the first time. I doodled those words on everything. The concept consumed me, whether I was sitting in a meeting with Rusty talking about student ministry, on the road with the band and on the phone with Shannon, or sitting in a church service with my journal, if I had a pen and paper in my hand, I scribbled down that phrase. A lifetime in 10 minutes. When we moved back to Texas, Mercy Me was gaining momentum as a band, but still working independent of any record label, manager, or agency, just as we had from the start. As we had vowed, we stayed completely out of the Christian music industry altogether. We worked hard to stay in God's will and to pay the bills. We traveled full-time, playing churches and conferences every weekend, and our summers were filled with leading worship at week-long youth camps. After that showcase night in Nashville, our concerts focused heavily on praise and worship, but with a rock and pop sound. We had recorded Traces of Rain in 1996, right before we left Oklahoma for Nashville. And then, just when you thought it couldn't get any better or wetter, released Traces of Rain Volume 2 in 1997, having recorded that project right after we moved from Nashville to Dallas. Both of those projects were our versions of other people's popular worship songs, covers, as they're called. Even in my high school years, I knew I wanted to be involved with guys who together would create and play original music. As a band, we were so ready to write and record our own music because our goal was to lead people into God's presence using songs we had written. We wanted to cut our next record, our fifth independent release, as soon as possible. We decided to call it The Worship Project, and it would turn out to be the game changer for us. Late one night, we were on the bus headed back home to Texas after leading worship at a student conference all weekend. The next morning, we were going to begin one final day of recording, but we still wanted one more song for the project. I told the guys I wanted to work on some lyrics, so they agreed to let me skip my driving shift to write, which was a big deal. Taking your designated shift was mandatory. Looking for a clean page, I thumbed through the journal where I wrote down new ideas. I kept coming across where I had written, I can only imagine. It was everywhere. I hadn't realized how much I had jotted down those words. In that moment, I finally saw the phrase so clearly. As in my moments of realization with Shannon, the words had been there all along, right in front of me. Now the timing, God's timing, was right for this new song to be born. I found a brand new page and grabbed a pen. As fast as I could write, the words came. I can only imagine what it'll be like when I walk by your side. I can only imagine what my eyes will see when your face is before me. I can only imagine. I can only imagine. Surrounded by your glory, what will my heart feel? Will I dance for you, Jesus, or in all of you be still? Will I stand in your presence, or to my knees will I fall? Will I sing hallelujah? Will I be able to speak at all? I can only imagine. I can only imagine. I can only imagine when that day comes, when I find myself standing in the sun. I can only imagine when all I do is forever, forever worship you. I can only imagine. I can only imagine. I wrote the lyrics just like that the very first time, as they were on the original recording, as they still are today. No tweaks, no changes. That was the only time in my history of writing that I've written a song start to finish in 10 minutes. I've heard such stories from my musical heroes, but it had never come close to happening to me until that moment. After I read over the lyrics, I felt the song was right just as it was, which is not at all the norm for me, or for most songwriters I know. I was pumped. It was now very late at night, or better said, really early in the morning. There's always been something cool about creating art, just God and me in the stillness, when the rest of the world is fast asleep. That's when I usually do my best work. Shannon was asleep among the guys sprawled out on the mattresses. I quietly woke her up, handed her the journal where I had scribbled out the lyrics, and asked her to read them. Bleary-eyed, she sat up. I watched her slowly scan down the page. I don't recall exactly what she said, but her middle-of-the-night sleepyhead response was not the over-the-top excitement I expected to receive. Honestly, I was a bit bummed that she didn't show more enthusiasm. I suggested she just go back to sleep, which she gladly did. I, on the other hand, was so excited that I couldn't sleep the rest of the night. Shannon responded much better when she read them again the next morning, when she was wide awake. Shannon's side of the story. Bart woke me up in the middle of the night and told me he wanted me to look at a new song he had just written. I could tell he was excited, but waking me up to read song lyrics wasn't that unusual for Bart. I scanned down the page at the very moving words. When I got to the end, I knew the significance of the song right away. I told him I thought it was really special. Now, when you wake a girl up in the middle of the night, expecting some amazing response from her just isn't very fair. Give me another shot in the morning after a cup of coffee and things will be different, I promise. Which is exactly what happened. But regardless, I always fondly recall that memory when Imagine was born as a spiritually magical moment in our lives. From pen to production. When we arrived in Texas, we went straight to our makeshift studio in a Sunday school room at the church in Greenville. We had only one more day in the room before we had to clear out our gear. So as soon as we got all the equipment up and running, I showed the guys the lyrics and my idea for the melody, and we started working out the music and arrangement. When the band jumped into the mix, it quickly became a fast rock song. That concept wasn't at all what was in my head, so I got frustrated. "Hey, guys, let's just forget this for now," I said. "We'll work on it another time." The lyrics were so special to me, and in my super protective state, I felt marrying them to the perfect melody was really crucial. After a while, we started breaking down our gear and packing up. Jim was still sitting at the piano, and I heard him randomly play three notes in sequence. I walked over to him and said, "Play those notes you just played again." "You mean this?" he asked, repeating them on the keyboard. Excitedly, I said, "That's it." Those ended up being the first three notes you hear in the intro to the song. The melody started coming together, and I asked the guys to get their gear back out. Over the next hour or so, the song gelled. We ended up cutting the entire song that day, so in about 18 hours, Imagine went from an idea scribbled on a page to being a fully finished and recorded song. I knew I had finally written a song using Mama Millard's captivating line about what I envisioned Dad's experience in heaven must be like. But none of us had any idea that it might have a major impact on people. So we ended up putting Imagine as the fifth song on the worship project. We didn't even add it into our worship set, although it was a vertical offering sung to God. Most worship songs have a single verse and a chorus because a second verse doesn't allow the song to fit on a single PowerPoint slide. One of Mercy Me's inside jokes has always been, is it a 7-Eleven song? In other words, is it a song with a 7-word chorus that you can sing 11 times? Worship songs have always had a simpler structure than typical songs, so they are easy to sing along with. In contrast, Imagine had the regular song pattern of 2 verses and a bridge with a repeated chorus. So for a long time, Imagine was almost a secret. The song got zero attention from us or anyone else. Looking back now, it would have been so easy for it to stay hidden in the middle of that little independent record and never see the light of day. But God had another plan for sure, far beyond what we would have ever dreamed possible. A random request. When God wants something to happen, He always makes a way. I believe we call those miracles. Here's one of ours. In 2000, we were leading worship at a youth camp when someone asked us if we could play Imagine during the altar call. What? Imagine? The request took the entire band by surprise. We had never done the song live before, and we had never had anyone request that we play it. We always worked hard to accommodate the people where we served, so while the event speaker was preaching the message, we were backstage going over everyone's parts. We were learning how to play the song live literally half an hour before we went out to perform it. The preacher set up the invitation, and for the first time, we played Imagine in front of an audience. As the song ended, we all thought we had really blown it. Because of the bright stage lights, we couldn't see the crowd's reaction, and we were confused as to why it was so quiet. But just then, the house lights came up a bit, and after our eyes adjusted, we saw the altar was covered with people who were on their knees, crying and embracing one another. We thought nothing had happened, but something definitely had. The Lord had used the song to touch people in a unique way. That was the Genesis moment, the start of God using Imagine, time and time again in countless situations all over the world. Almost from that moment, the song began gaining traction. Because of the strong response, we started singing Imagine at every event, and things began to change. Before releasing the Worship Project, if we sold 1,000 CDs in a year, we thought we were doing amazing. But that next year, because of the popularity of the song, we sold 130,000. I had seen an interview with MC Hammer where he said that if you sell 100,000 CDs out of the trunk of your car at your shows, it was the same as selling 1 million while on a record label. For obvious reasons, I latched onto that comment. Now our audience was growing and we started getting more and more attention. Bigger, more established bands heard us at youth conferences and told their record labels to check us out. We made enough money to put everyone on salary, including health insurance. We even started our own 401ks. Believe me, those are highly unusual financial feats for any band. At the same time, our growth became overwhelming behind the scenes. We struggled to keep up with booking, management, publicity, CD and merchandise inventory, and marketing. Add traveling, playing more than 200 dates a year, writing and recording, we found ourselves weighed down with all the work that goes into keeping a band afloat, aside from the 2 hours on stage every night. There was no relief in sight. Our old friend Brickle found out about Imagine and listened to it, and then he listened again. And again. Then he made a phone call to Mark Stewart of Audio A. Mark came to Brickle's office, lay down on the floor with headphones on, in his classic laid-back Stewart style, and listened to the track. Brickle watched him for a response, any response. Mark's eyes were closed. He was into it. When the song ended, he sat there a moment before asking, "Bart wrote this?" He did. Mark just smiled, shook his head in a go-figure fashion, and said, "This is really an amazing song." Brickle laughed. "I know, I can't stop listening to it." Mark decided that he would make it his mission to get our band signed to a record label. True to his word, with Brickle's watchful guidance, he went to all the major labels and got turned down. For Mercy Me, this was just the same song, second verse. We had been down this road before. Now a major artist and manager were going to bat for us, and still nothing was connecting. But in a plot twist that none of us could see coming, God had something waiting right around the corner. Providential phone call number one. Mercy Me was in Des Moines, Iowa, leading worship at a weekend student conference. At the time, we had a band cell phone that we all shared. During a break at the event, our phone rang. I saw it was a 615 area code, so I knew it was a Nashville number. When I answered, the woman on the other end said, "Is this Bart Millard? Hey, this is Amy Grant." I laughed. This had to be a joke by one of my prankster friends. Probably one of the guys in the band getting me back for something I had pulled in the past, so I promptly hung up. And then the cell phone rang again, same number. In that heart-racing moment, I thought, oh man, I might have actually just laughed at and hung up on my hero. I answered, and Amy quickly said, "Bart, it's really me, Amy Grant. Don't hang up. Hey, I heard your song, and I love it. I really want to record it, release it as a single to radio, and put it on my next album." I was completely shocked. "I appreciate this so much," I said, "but I'll need to talk this over with the band. I will call you back as soon as possible." When I told the guys that Amy Grant wanted to record Imagine, they didn't believe me at all. Like me, they thought it was a prank or a joke. And given my track record, who could blame them? Finally, I showed them the number on the phone, and they started freaking out as much as I was. We all saw time and time again the truth in Proverbs 19:21. "You can make many plans, but the Lord's purpose will prevail." New Living Translation. We get lots of phone calls in our lives, but only a handful of those are life-changing. That one was particularly special to me because it had God's fingerprints all over it. Amy Grant, the queen of CCM, the singer who, with her angelic voice and words of peaceful comfort, had gotten me through so many moments of pain when I was younger, called Bart Millard, the kid from Greenville, Texas, who sings in a little indie worship band. Her music had been a major lifeline for me when I was a kid, and she was now going to record my song, my dad's song. The band had told me that the decision regarding the song was up to me since I was the sole writer, but honestly, I never thought twice about signing Imagine over to her. We had already released another independent album titled Look that we were busy promoting, and anything Amy records is going to do well and travel far, given how many of her songs are now part of classic CCM history. As the news of Amy's offer got out around Nashville, guess what happened? The same Christian labels that had turned us down at least twice before started calling. "Hey, we heard Amy is cutting one of your songs," they said. "We need to talk to you guys again." Providential phone call number two. By this time, Shannon and I were shipping Mercy Me product from our garage to around 400 Christian bookstores. The increased interest in the band and the calls from labels in Nashville only added to our exhaustion. We were doing everything ourselves, and I knew it was time to get some help. I called Mark Maxwell, a music lawyer we had gotten to know when we were in Nashville. I knew he believed in Mercy Me. I told him everything that was going on and explained that we desperately needed help. He suggested I call a respected guy in the CCM industry named Jeff Mosley. Mark was clear that Jeff would likely turn us down. He dealt with much bigger artists. But he said I should start with him as the best first try. We did a little checking and found out that Jeff had been in Christian music for more than 20 years and had held positions of general manager of Myrrh Records and president of Reunion Records, Star Song Records, and Benson Records. He had been at the helm of several major Christian labels and in charge of many high-profile and best-selling projects. But Jeff was growing weary of the traditional model and was ready to do something unique. In 1999, he started his own label, working with established artists, which is exactly why Mark figured he wouldn't talk to us. What no one else knew was that Jeff was looking for new, unsigned artists who were already walking out their calling from God and who wanted to be in a partnership with a label, not just have someone dictate what they did in their careers. We wanted to maintain creative control and pay for our projects ourselves, and we wanted a label to come alongside us to focus on what they do best: radio promotion, marketing to the masses, and distribution to the stores. Providential phone call number three. To my surprise, I got through to Jeff on the first try. I told him what we were hoping to find in a label. He told me that he was on another line and needed to put me on hold for a minute to wrap up the other call. The reason that little detail is important is that he was on a call with his wife, and right as I was calling in, he had asked her to pray that God would bring him clarity on his new venture, even if he has to call me on the phone himself. That's so God, right? He came back on the line and asked me to tell him the entire Mercy Me story. I told him everything, including our Christian bookstore sales numbers. Later, he called about 50 stores and verified the numbers I gave him. Everything checked out. Jeff and I talked on a Thursday, and I FedExed him the Worship Project CD for a Friday morning delivery. I included a note about two or three songs for him to focus on. As he played Imagine for his wife that weekend, he told her, "I want to sign this band, and I think we're going to need to take out a second mortgage on our house to fund this. Are you okay with that?" She agreed, and he booked a flight to Texas for Tuesday. With the entire band sitting in my living room and listening intently, Jeff explained the vision for his label and how we could work together. If we'd had any doubts before, they were gone now. He removed every downside of us signing with him. We had found the perfect fit with a record label. It all made sense to everyone. Had we signed a multi-year deal with any of those other companies, this would never have happened. God connected the dots for us once again. Jeff told us if we were going to have a record deal with his company, we would need to have an official manager who knew all the aspects of the industry well, someone who would provide oversight and creative focus, put legs to our dreams, and represent all aspects of the business end of our careers. As Brickell always says, managing artists is a lot like herding cats. Jeff had no idea that an established veteran like Brickell had been helping us and that he already had a seat on our bus, so to speak. We called Brickell right away to tell him about Jeff's plan, and he was ready. So in 2001, 7 years after our mountaintop call from God moment in the Swiss Alps, we signed our first record contract with newly formed INO Records, known as Fair Trade Services today, with Jeff Mosley running point. We also signed a management agreement with the guy who had already served us so graciously for free for so many years. Brickell hit the ground running and connected us with Mike and Lisa Snyder at Third Coast Artist Agency to handle all the booking of our tours and live events. A great agency with a network of relationships can put your band into places you could never book yourself. At that time, TCAA's major acts were Skillet, Caveman's Call, and Bebo Norman, so we were excited and humbled to be on their roster. In his way and in his timing, God had now put all the pieces in place for Mercy Me to make the best music we could with the best team on the planet. More than 15 years later, we're still with the same key people, Brickell, Jeff, and Mike. That's an anomaly in the music business. But God specializes in creating those, doesn't he? Small world, big God. Several years after we had been working with Brickell, we were all hanging out and started swapping back-in-the-day stories about other CCM artists. I told one from when I was in junior high, around the same time Dad had checked out on me and told me he no longer cared what I did. I'd entered a local singing contest, and the winner got to sing one song as the opener for a touring Christian artist who was coming through town. The winner, along with a friend, also got to eat pizza with the singer before the show. Well, I entered, won, and took Kent with me. The artist had a young guy with him acting as road manager who was carrying his gear, setting up, and running sound. During dinner, Kent and I quietly made fun of the artist's latest album title because we thought it was really cheesy. One of us would say something at normal volume, then mutter the line under our breath to each other, followed by a giggle in that annoying way that only junior high boys can. The artist was paying zero attention to us anyway. Saying how I made one final joke to Kent, I was building everyone up in the room to my punchline when Brickell suddenly interrupted me. Then a piece of pepperoni flew across the table and hit you right in the middle of the forehead, just like David Stone hit Goliath, right? I was speechless and shocked, and it's hard to get me to be either. I blurted, "Yeah, how in the world could you know that?" Brickell just grinned in his classic possum style and said, "'Cause I was the guy who threw it at you. I heard what you both were saying about his album, and I was ready to put a stop to it. I was the road manager for that artist." That Christian artist was Brian Becker, who we later became friends with, and we've all laughed together about this story. For the record, Brian made fun of that album, too. It is indeed a small world, is it not? Only God could have had Brickell and me unknowingly cross paths way back then, during one of the worst times of my life. Brickell was working with a touring artist, and I was opening the concert as a singer 10 years before we would meet again in exactly the same roles. But the next time, no flying pepperoni was involved. Chapter 10. Keep Singing. But when I am stuck and I can't move, when I don't know what I should do, when I wonder if I will make it through, I gotta keep singing. I gotta keep praising your name. Mercy Me, Keep Singing, from Undone 2004. With Jeff at INO Records now in the mix, we decided that Amy would press on with recording Imagine, but we would also put it on our first major label release. Then, when Amy sent the song to Christian Radio, we would simultaneously send our first single, a different song, spinning it as a new release from the band that brought you Amy Grant's hit song, I Can Only Imagine. There was just one glitch with this plan. It was exactly that, our plan. When you're dealing with major league, legendary level, high demand artists who have a big machine behind them, everything moves slowly, very slowly. Mercy Me had once written, recorded, and released 2 albums in 1 year. So we were accustomed to knocking things out, or kicking butt and taking names, as we say in Texas. We learned the hard way that is not reality in the world of professional music. An afternoon with Amy. While we were sitting impatiently in the music industry's metaphorical waiting room, Amy called and offered to fly Shannon and me to Nashville to visit with her and her record producer, Brown Bannister, in the recording studio where Imagine was being cut. I was a huge fan of Brown's work, as I had listened to all the artists whose projects he had produced over the years. Bottom line, I was going to have the privilege of sitting down with two of my musical heroes. Shannon and I flew into Nashville, and Brickell picked us up at the airport. We drove to Franklin, a historic suburb just south of the city. Amy's project was being recorded in the famous Sound Kitchen studio, where so many amazing Christian albums, ones I had owned and listened to countless times, have been recorded. Amy wasn't there when we arrived, but Brown wanted to go ahead and play me the track so I could hear what had been recorded to get an idea of the song's sound. He hit play, and from out of the studio's mega speakers, this huge, anthem-like version of Imagine roared into the room. By the time the final note faded away, I was in absolute awe. Brown said, "You'll have to forgive me for the track still being kind of bare. The London Symphony Orchestra hasn't been added yet." I had no idea how to respond, but I was thinking, what am I doing here and what is happening right now? Let's just say that Brown's track sounded way better than anything we had produced in the daycare center in Oklahoma City or in the Sunday school room in Texas. If this were a text, I'd insert the crying laughing emoji here. By that point, Amy had slipped into the room and was standing behind us. Brown smiled, and I knew that she must be here. I turned around to face Amy and her manager, Jennifer Cook. I was starstruck, dumbfounded, and any other word for out of my mind you want to insert here. I think I said something like, "You're Bart, and I'm Miss Amy. No, wait, I'm sorry. Well, you know who you are. I'm Bart, and this is my wife, Shannon." Amy's calm demeanor put me at ease quickly. After a few minutes, I became relatively normal again and was able to speak somewhat intelligibly. Brown, Brickell, and Jennifer graciously excused themselves into another room and left Amy to visit with Shannon and me in the studio's control room. As we talked, Amy told me for the first time how she had heard Imagine. Jennifer had a dear friend who was very ill in the hospital. The friend told her that she had to hear this amazing song. When she listened to Imagine, she thought it would be perfect for me. She put the CD into my car stereo system so it would play when I got in. After I heard it, I called Jennifer in tears. I told her how I'd already played it at least 50 times. Then I asked her, where in the world did this song come from? Amy then paused and asked me, "Bart, where did this song come from?" I swallowed hard. You know, I've never told anybody my story. My dad was a monster. I mean, that's the only word for it. And I saw God transform him from a man I hated into the man I wanted to become, into my best friend. This song was born out of that experience. It took me about 10 minutes to write it late one night on the bus. She smiled sweetly, leaned in toward me, and said, "Bart, you didn't write this song in 10 minutes. It took a lifetime." She continued, "This song is a career maker, and I know some songs can really be personal to the writer. Is that what you really want, to allow someone else to record your song and tell your story?" This generous question showed Amy's character and wisdom. She knew whoever released Imagine would, from that point forward, be connected to its message. And she was asking me face to face if I was okay with what was actually my story being forever associated with her. "I want as many people as possible to hear it. You can do that." "We can't," I said. "So yes. This is what I want." When we had finished talking and everyone came back into the control room, Amy looked at Brown and then back at me. She laughed and said, "Well, Bart, it's time for me to start the vocals, and I'd prefer to not sing them in front of you." I laughed, too, knowing what it feels like for a vocalist to sing in front of the songwriter. We hugged, and Shannon and I said our goodbyes. Grace and Favor. A year later, we had finished our first INO full-length album, Almost There, but Amy still hadn't released Imagine. The band, Brickell, and Jeff all knew we needed to send a song to radio. Every evangelical church in America was reading and talking about a Christian book based on the prayer of Jabez from 1 Chronicles 4. So we wrote and recorded a song called Bless Me Indeed, Jabez's Song. This became our first official radio single. While it might have sounded like a good idea on paper to ride the coattails of the book's momentum, the song absolutely tanked. Very few stations played it, and our record sales started dropping. Needless to say, things were not going according to plan. In football language, we were behind in the fourth quarter. It was fourth down with no timeouts left, and only seconds remained on the clock. Jeff was about to send out our second single to radio, but he asked if someone would contact Amy's team one last time to see if they were still planning to release Imagine. Brickell put in the call. At 5:15 p.m. that same day, her team responded to him with a message from Amy herself. Amy had heard about the band's dilemma. She said she knew how a song could change everything in a musician's career and how an artist could spend a lifetime trying to come up with a song like this. But we had already done it. Amy assured us that Imagine was ours, not hers, and she would sign the recording rights back to us. Who does that in the entertainment industry, much less in the music business? Brickell called us immediately and told us about Amy's blessing. When I found out, I called her myself. "Bart, you need to finish what you started," she said. "This is your story. It's your song. You guys need to release it as your own single." Brickell called Jeff right away to stop the new single from being mailed out. Jeff was, of course, ecstatic about the news. He had wanted to send out the song as the band's single all along, and now it was finally going to happen. Remember that second mortgage he had taken out? His team took off in a mad dash. They unpacked the old CDs, burned Imagine onto new ones, repackaged them, and drove to the FedEx center at the Nashville airport, arriving just before the planes left. Meanwhile, I got on the phone in the middle of the night and left messages on radio station answering machines to say our new single was coming on Monday. It was a whirlwind weekend. Imagine reached radio stations on October 12, 2001. The first week, 13 stations added to their playlist. 19 more added the second week, and 9 more the week after. Within a month, 41 of the top 43 stations were playing the song, just as Brickell, Jeff, Amy, Jennifer, and Mark Stewart all knew would happen. Christian radio programmers loved the song and started playing it in heavy rotation. That's radio lingo for all the stinking time. Milestone moments. In early January 2002, I was scheduled to call in for a live interview with John Rivers, the legendary host of 20 The Countdown magazine, a nationwide syndicated radio program that counted down the top 20 songs in Christian music each week. John always had a special guest artist on the show for each broadcast, and he had invited me on. While I was on hold, waiting for John to come on the line, I held my sleeping newborn son, Sam, born on January 4th, in my arms. Shannon walked in from getting the mail, holding out a specific envelope toward me. It was the final $600 check for my dad's pension, the last one. All those years, and this was the end of the road. $600 represented a lot of money in our monthly budget. Fear gripped my heart. What am I going to do? How can I possibly replace that income? I have a newborn son, I thought. Lord help, I prayed. John picked up the phone to start the interview, jarring me out of my financial panic. In his stellar radio voice, he said, "Well, Bart, so many of us know the story of you writing Imagine about your dad's death. How proud do you think he would be with the big news today? What do you think he might say to you?" I had no idea what he meant, no clue what he was referring to. "I'm sorry, I don't think I know what you mean." John laughed. "Well, then let me be the first to congratulate you. This morning, I Can Only Imagine hit number one at Christian radio all across the country. You have the number one song in all of Christian music." There, on live radio, I started to weep. I couldn't believe it. I remembered how, when Dad told me about the pension, he said, "I don't know what will happen after 10 years, but I'm sure I will find a way to keep taking care of you." On the very day that the last check arrived, the song I wrote about Dad and for Dad went to number one. He had indeed found a way to keep taking care of his son. Right on time, on the exact day, at just the perfect moment, as I held his grandson in my arms. No one can write better scripts than God. Everyone in the Christian music industry had known about Amy's plan to release Imagine as her first single on her new album, but we had released the song as our own, and it had gone to number one on the Christian charts. Amy had scheduled a major concert at the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville during Gospel Music Association week in April. Back then, the event culminated with the Dove Awards, which is kind of like the Christian Grammys, on the week before Easter Sunday. So many people were asking questions about the song and why we were releasing it instead of Amy, so Brickell called to work out a plan with her team. We wanted to show how everyone worked together toward the decision. At the concert, Amy shared how Imagine had affected her. She said that she loved it but realized the song needed to be sung by the writer who had lived the story. She did an amazing job of explaining why the song was first being released by us and then later, in a slightly different version, by her on her upcoming Hymns album. Then came that surreal moment when I took the stage to sing the second verse and finish out the song with her. For many years, Mercy Me had worked so hard to make it as a band and to be well-known and respected artist in her own right. Since I was a kid, I had been Christian music's biggest fan, and now I was sharing in the legacy of my beloved music. Mercy Me was still relatively unknown at that point, so the media was all over me for comments afterwards. They had no idea who I was. Years later, someone who was there that night told me he had never seen a grin as big as the one I was wearing. But later that night, once everything had had a chance to sink in, I wept with the realization that, for the first time I could remember, life was better than anything I had ever dreamed in my imagination. At the Dove Awards later that week, Imagine won Song of the Year and Pop Contemporary Recorded Song of the Year. I was humbled and honored to also win Songwriter of the Year. It is still so ironic to me that I have worked so many long hours on so many songs, but won that coveted award for the song I wrote the fastest. The song that won't go away. Imagine had stayed at number one on Christian radio for weeks in 2002. Then one morning in 2003, someone called into a mainstream FM radio station in Dallas and dared the DJ to play Imagine. The station aired a popular morning program called The Fitz Show. whose on-air personality often played a truth or dare type game on air. Callers would challenge him to do random, sometimes crude things. Once the caller explained what the song was about, the DJ said, not just no, but no way. But one of the producers at the station just so happened to be a Christian who was attending seminary to prepare for the ministry. He later told me that he believed God had brought him to that station to make a difference. The producer got the song and urged the DJ to play it. He finally agreed to do so as a joke for his listeners. A friend called to tell me about the mainstream station playing Imagine right at that moment. I thought it had to be a prank or else my friend had to be wrong about what he heard. I was at home, so I turned on the radio and tuned the dial to 100.3. The DJ was telling people to please stop calling. They would play the song again later. I couldn't believe it. This was for real. The rest of the morning show was dedicated to playing Imagine. People called in to talk about what the words meant to them and how it made them feel. The DJ even said at one point, what is the deal with this song? The phones just kept ringing with people asking what the name of the band was and how to get the song. The station also had a weekly online popularity contest that gave listeners the opportunity to vote for their favorite song. The next week, Imagine went to number one at that station and stayed there for several months, winning out over all the mainstream pop songs of the day. Can you believe a song about Jesus in heaven beat out songs about partying and clubbing? The DJ said that he had been told that Mercy Me lived in the Dallas area, so Bart, if you're listening, please call us. So I phoned in and he invited the band to be on the show. In an interview around that time, Jeff Mosley, the head of INO, talked about the mainstream attention saying, it was a surprise and it wasn't. We have felt for a long time like there was more to Imagine than the long run at Christian radio. We thought it could make an impact at mainstream. At the same time, we recognized that we couldn't do it ourselves. Something was going to have to make it happen. Well, that something certainly did occur in a way no one would ever have dreamed up. I kept thinking that if there were a list titled Top 5 Christian Songs That Were Never Meant to Cross Over to Mainstream, I would have for sure put Imagine down as one of them. After all, it came complete with the J word in the lyrics, something rarely done in secular media, and the message was so blatantly and unapologetically Christian. Other mainstream stations around the country heard about the song's success in the Dallas market and started to play it. A representative of Curb Records called Jeff and said they wanted to help get the song out to a broader audience, so our label partnered with them. They sent it out to every reporting radio station in the country with a simple, singular, printed message. Play it once. If you get a response, great. If you don't, throw it away. The song went to number one in virtually every market where it was played. One programmer reported, I heard Imagine on another station and decided to play it. The first time I gave no introduction or announcement, and I immediately started getting calls and emails from people about the song. Another said, Imagine is the first song with a blatant Christian message that we've added in 16 years. When asked about the mainstream attention, I always said that unless somebody has a vendetta against God, the song is not a threat to anyone, believer or not. It just makes you ask a lot of questions like, what's next after this life? And what if this heaven place is real? We had the incredible privilege of assuring people that we believe it is. The world is our mission field, and Mercy Me's fans have always supported us by praying that we will maintain the message and make a difference for the kingdom of God. We had released our major label project called Spoken For in 2002, and everyone on our team had been busy promoting it. When mainstream radio blew up, we had to switch gears and go back to work on Almost There because of all the sudden attention Imagine was getting. That season was full of a ton of hard work, but it was an amazing time. We led worship at a Christian conference and then flew to Los Angeles to be on Ryan Seacrest's radio show. We played a denominational conference in an arena and then played The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. Having a hit on Christian and mainstream stations produces some really interesting opportunities. Here are a few stats to put into perspective what had happened. Almost There released in August 2001 and was certified gold, 500,000 in sales within 10 months. Our second album, Spoken For, was released 3 months later. Our first single, also titled Spoken For, went to number one on Christian radio. Our second single, Word of God Speak, went to number one on Christian radio. Almost There was certified platinum, 1 million in sales in July of 2003. Spoken For was certified gold in October of 2003. Word of God Speak from the Spoken For album won the Dove Award for Song of the Year in 2004. After the mainstream radio miracle occurred, Almost There sold another 1 million records. And as developing technology changed the way we buy music, Imagine became the first Christian song to reach 2 million downloads sold. In December 2017, Almost There was certified as triple platinum, sales of 3 million, making Mercy Me only the second Christian artist in history to reach this milestone, behind our friend Amy Grand. It is absolutely crazy to me that as I write this, 17 years after its debut, Imagine just hit number one yet again on the iTunes Christian chart. Only God could have orchestrated such a miraculous way to have millions of people hear about heaven and their own opportunity to see Jesus face to face. We won't know until Christ returns how many people have been affected by such a simple song based on a phrase from my mama Millard. In every interview about the song I've ever done, I've told the story about my dad. Imagine is an ongoing tribute to my heavenly father and to my earthly father. Dad always told me he would be forgotten soon after he was gone, but his attachment to this song has kept his story alive. What a legacy. Mercy Me's prayer has always been that God would use us in this generation as he did the biblical psalmist in theirs. What an immense privilege to think that a song we wrote might outlive the band. We just want to lead people to the throne of God through celebration, worship, and praise. We were doing this long before worship music became commercial, and we want to keep doing it as long as the Lord allows and calls us to lead. Why shouldn't we? That is the very reason we were created. Looking back on my life through all the faith and fear, victories and failures, mountains and valleys, this one thing I know, just like the song says, Lord Jesus, I will forever, forever worship you. Conclusion. Even if. They say it only takes a little faith to move a mountain. Well, good thing. A little faith is all I have right now. But God, when you choose to leave mountains unmovable, give me the strength to be able to sing, It Is Well With My Soul. Mercy Me, Even If, from Lifer 2017. Let's get real. I can see how it would be easy for you to read about the hit songs, awards, celebrities, and spotlights on stages all over the country, and then do the math on selling millions of records. You could quickly come to the conclusion that my early years were really tough, but then the metaphorical yellow brick road led me to the classic storybook ending. From that point on, life was all unicorns and rainbows, right? It was really tempting to end the book with the previous chapter. Imagine went to number one and we all lived happily ever after. The end. Good night. God bless you. Thanks for coming. We'll see you next time we're in town. As I mentioned up front, the movie was forced to tell my story in under 2 hours because that's the nature of the format. But here I've had time to kick back and dig into the details. You've been able to put a bookmark in my life and jump back in when you wanted. But if we're going to be honest about following Christ, we have to talk about the doubts with the faith, the questions with the answers, and the trials with the triumphs. So let's pull back the curtain and go backstage. Get on the bus, Gus. Let me tell you about my life in 2004 and 2005, following the controlled chaos of 2002 and 2003. While Mercy Me was experiencing the best year ever as a band, I was going through the worst year of my personal life. When you have the biggest hit song in history in your musical genre, the pressure from the industry is unbelievable, almost unbearable. Everyone expected another power ballad to match or even rival Imagine. How in the world do you top that? Can you top that? Especially when it was so obviously a work of the Lord. You don't just send up a prayer and schedule those into your life. That's why they call it God's will. Just don't ruin what we've got became Mercy Me's unspoken motto. That attitude permeated the band's being. We were working so hard just to not derail the momentum that the hit song had built. When you start buying into the hype, taking on other people's pressures and expectations, and working from such a negative perspective, you can't possibly enjoy what you're doing. And you also can't try anything new and venture into fresh territory because the past is always banging on your front door. We were just a little worship band from Texas that wanted to make music and honor the Lord, but now everything we dreamed of and hoped for had come true. At the same time, life got really, really complicated. Life before and after 2004. For Shannon and me, 2004 was one of those eternal time markers. We actually refer to our lives as pre-2004 and post-2004. Late one January night, Shannon's 19-year-old brother Chris showed up at our door in Greenville. We had moved back to our hometown in 1998 and said he really needed to talk to us. He had just had his heart broken, and he was distraught. Shannon had been his champion no matter what, and she'd always supported and believed in him. So we talked with him for hours into the middle of the night. But he started getting rude with her, and I told him someone ought to take him outside and knock some sense into him. He asked me if I was going to be the one to do that. I clarified that I was just trying to say he desperately needed to straighten up and think through his life. Soon after, he headed toward the front door. He opened it and stopped and turned to us. Tell Sam I love him, he said. Sam was 2 years old. We tried to get him to stay, but he refused. It didn't take long for Shannon to get concerned about what he had said and how he had said it. She asked me to try to find him. I knew where he was staying, so I drove there. Nothing. I went everywhere I thought he might have gone, but couldn't locate him. Finally, early in the morning, I headed back home and went to bed. At 8 in the morning, our phone rang. It was Shannon's dad. After Chris left our house, he fell asleep at the wheel. The one car accident on a local back road had been fatal. Shannon was in hysterics. We were both devastated. When the initial shock wore off, it hit me. I had upset him. I thought, I'm responsible for my brother-in-law's death. No matter how much anyone tried to reassure me that I couldn't have done anything to prevent what had happened, it didn't matter. I couldn't shake it. The guilt was unbearable. I carried that burden around with me along with all my other ones, old and new baggage together. But this one was different. This was about someone's death. I replayed in my mind what I could have said, what I shouldn't have said, what I should have done. The loop seemed endless. 3 months later, in April 2004, Shannon got pregnant with our second child. In early November, Shannon started having contractions, but she was still 6 weeks away from her due date. The doctor and nurses at the hospital determined our baby girl was indeed coming prematurely, and there was a great deal of concern because of development issues that can often affect preemies. A lot can go wrong when a birth is that early. On November 4th, 2004, Gracie Millard came into the world. By the grace of God, she and Shannon were fine, and in a few days, we took our tiny new daughter home to join our son, Sam. Just after we got home from the hospital, I had to fly to L.A. to attend the American Music Awards. Mercy Me had been nominated for Favorite Contemporary Inspirational Artist. Sheryl Crow was the presenter, and when she opened the envelope, she called our name. Because of the time difference between California and Texas, I didn't call Shannon until the next morning, after I had gotten to the airport. As soon as she answered, I said, "Hey, we won, and Sheryl Crow gave us our award." "Something is wrong with Sam," she replied, as though she hadn't heard me. "I've taken him to his pediatrician, but as soon as you get home, we need to take him to Children's Hospital in Dallas." Sam was constantly thirsty, as if he couldn't get enough to drink. He was also very fatigued, unusually so for a toddler. Of course, my entire focus changed. I just needed to get back home as quickly as I could. By the time I arrived, Shannon's parents had already come to the house to take care of Gracie, and we left right away to take Sam to the hospital. My American Music Award now sat unnoticed in the floorboard of the car. Interesting how priorities can so quickly change. After running some tests, the doctors diagnosed Sam with juvenile diabetes. I asked, "So he'll outgrow this, right? This isn't permanent." When he explained what Sam had as an incurable illness, my heart broke into a million pieces. "He's still just a baby," I thought. Nothing hurts more than when something happens to one of your kids, especially if it's something you have zero control over. Nothing in this life is more difficult than when your little boy begs, "Fix it, Daddy," and you tell him that you can't. Everything in you screams because you want more than anything to stop his suffering. We spent the next week in the hospital, learning more than we ever wanted to know about shots, blood tests, and diet restrictions. Every day we had to give Sam 4 or 5 shots and prick his finger 10 times, and he had no idea why. It was overwhelming for all of us, especially because Gracie had just come home from the hospital. Shannon was still recovering from childbirth and taking care of a newborn, so I had to step up to the plate in learning all the details of Sam's new lifestyle. Eventually, because Sam was such an easygoing and resilient kid, he adapted, but the added responsibilities, rigid schedule, and restricted diet was a major game changer for our family, especially after years of living the unpredictable life of a musician. An offer I couldn't refuse. The next weekend, the band was supposed to play in Pasadena, California at the Rose Bowl for what would be one of Billy Graham's last evangelical crusade appearances. Brickell called Dr. Graham's office and explained that the band would have to cancel due to what had happened with Sam. I just couldn't leave my family for the 2 to 3 days it would take for the bus trip. The Graham folks were very understanding and accepted our regrets, but the next day, Dr. Graham's assistant called Brickell back. He wanted to make me an offer. If a private jet picked me up at 6 p.m. in Texas and I could be back home by midnight, would I consider coming? He added that Dr. Graham wanted a few minutes alone with the band to pray for Sam and our family. What could I say? Shannon and I agreed I should go. The band and crew went on via bus as scheduled. When I arrived at the Rose Bowl that evening, we were ushered into a covered area near the platform. On the other side, a number of security personnel appeared with a group of people, and we assumed Dr. Graham had been brought up to the stage. The press immediately began to congregate in that area, but that was only a planned diversion. Dr. Graham walked through the doorway in the stage covering. He smiled politely, introduced himself, and explained how they divert attention when he needs to visit privately with someone. He spoke with us briefly, thanked us for coming, and then prayed a beautiful, personal, heartfelt prayer over Sam and our family. It was a moment I will never, ever forget. We played our set at the crusade, and then, just as promised, I was back home with my family by midnight. Asking the hard questions. When you are perceived by the public to be a celebrity, people can